The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 24th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Judge Roy Moore standing on a stage at a podium. It's got the Republican symbol on the front. He's got on his cowboy hat, and he's obviously speaking and hanging on to the podium as hard as he can. And to his right, Mitch McConnell's got a hold of his arm, and he's trying to drag him away from the podium with a sort of a desperate look on his face. And the title headline says, Damage Control, McConnell's Desperate Effort to Remove Roy Moore. And that, in fact, is our first main story, GOP shaken by Moore's sex scandal. What happened? Senior Republicans called on former Judge Roy Moore to quit the U.S. Senate race in Alabama this week after the GOP candidate was accused of pursuing or sexually assaulting five teenagers in the late 1970s and 1980s. Lee Korfman, 53, told the Washington Post she was 14 when Moore, then a 32-year-old assistant district attorney, took her to his home and molested her. Beverly Young Nelson, 55, said Moore assaulted her in his car when she was 16, groping her and trying to force her head into his crotch. After she resisted, Nelson said, Moore told her no one would believe her if she spoke out because you're just a child. Three other women said Moore either dated or tried to date them when they were ages 16 to 18. The New Yorker reported that he was banned from the mall in his hometown, Gadsden, for bothering teenage girls. Moore, 70, dismissed the allegations as fake news, saying he didn't generally date teens when he was in his 30s. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell declared, I believe the women, and said he was considering asking Attorney General Jeff Sessions to mount a write-in campaign to win back his old seat. The Alabama Republican Party can withdraw Moore's nomination for the December 12th election, but it is too late for his name to be removed from the ballot. National Republican Senatorial Committee Chairman Cory Gardner said if Moore wins, the Senate should vote to expel him, a step that hasn't been taken since 1862. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said President Trump believed Moore should step aside if these allegations are true. What the editorial said. Moore has long been grossly unfit for high office, said Alabama's Birmingham News. He was twice dismissed as Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, first for refusing to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the judicial building, then for illegally enforcing a ban on same-sex marriage. But these sickening allegations, for which Moore has no credible defense, should be the final nail in his political coffin. It doesn't matter that there is no proof of his wrongdoing. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is a consideration for the courtroom, not the ballot box. Moore isn't the type to quit, said the Wall Street Journal. So President Trump should use his sway with the GOP base to pressure him to drop out. If that fails, Republicans should hope Democrat Doug Jones, who polls show is now leading or in a dead heat with Moore, emerges victorious. Yes, that would reduce the party's already narrow 52-48 Senate majority, making it harder to push through legislation. But if Moore is elected, Democrats will make him the running mate of every Republican in 2018. What the columnist said. Republicans' response to this scandal has been idiotic, said Matthew Walther in TheWeek.com. The if-true qualification, which McConnell himself deployed before declaring Moore unfit for office, is clearly ludicrous. What are they waiting for? Video evidence? But that wasn't the most outrageous response. Jim Ziegler, Alabama's state auditor, argued there was nothing immoral in Moore's alleged actions because the Virgin Mary was a teenager and Joseph an adult, and they became parents of Jesus. Blame Bill Clinton for this mess, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. Moore is simply following the 42nd president's playbook for dealing with sexual assault allegations. Deny all accusations, dismiss the scandal as conspiracy, and rally supporters against the other side. Bubba successfully mobilized the left to run interference for him, smearing his accusers, and got away with it. If Moore does the same, we can thank liberals. The fact that Trump was accused by 11 women of unwanted touching or kissing during the election makes this issue infinitely harder for Republicans, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. First, it raises the question of why they believe Moore's accusers, but not the president's. Second, it makes it tough for Trump to intervene. That leaves McConnell with few good options. The GOP base will view a write-in campaign as an effort to take Moore down by the very establishment he has vowed to fight. And a vote to expel Moore from the Senate would override the will of the electorate. Against that backdrop, it's really difficult to envy McConnell. And before we move on from this page, from the It Wasn't All Bad segment, a Marine veteran who lost both his legs in Afghanistan has completed a month of marathons, logging 31 long-distance runs in 31 days across the U.S. and Canada. Rob Jones, 32, lived out of an RV with his wife, mother, and a friend as he traveled from city to city. At each stop, the Virginia veteran would wake up, put on his prosthetics, and hit the streets. He concluded his final marathon at Washington's National Mall, raising at least $135,000 for veterans groups. Jones said he wanted to find a new way to contribute to my country and stay in the fight. And there's quite an impressive picture of him in action there with the story. And our controversy of the week. Trump in Asia, a test for America First. If the point of President Trump's 12-day tour of Asia was to reassure allies at a time of tension while clarifying U.S. policy toward the region, said Adam Taylor in the Washington Post, then the president went 0-for-2. Trump certainly seemed to enjoy himself on the trip, golfing with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, soaking up the pageantry at a state dinner inside China's Forbidden City. But his various statements added up to an incoherent message that left our allies more confused than ever. In Seoul, Trump gave a powerful speech denouncing North Korea's nuclear ambitions, said Julie Davis in the New York Times, and he showered lavish personal compliments on each of the leaders hosting him. But in Vietnam, Trump gave a strikingly hostile speech vowing to put America first in matters of trade, a starkly unilateralist approach that echoed the ugly anti-globalist rhetoric of his campaign. Trump may have survived the trip with no major gaffes, but it is not at all clear what he actually achieved. If Trump's policy is starkly unilateralist, so be it, said Irwin Stelzer in WeeklyStandard.com. Decades of flawed, one-sided trade deals have led to a great hollowing out of the U.S. industrial sector. Under the current rigged trade system, for example, U.S. firms have to go head-to-head with Chinese firms that enjoy protective tariffs, hefty subsidies from Beijing, and a domestic market ring-fenced to protect them from foreign competition. Trump was absolutely right to declare that he is not getting to let the United States be taken advantage of anymore. America first to Trump is not a purely selfish policy, but a model for the rest of the world to follow, said Jillian Turner in TheHill.com. Rather than pursue ever more entangled trade relations, Trump was saying in essence that every Asian leader should help his or her country become its best self. The president failed to put America first on his egocentric adulation tour, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Frankly, this trip felt more like a pilgrimage than a projection of power, with Trump flattering autocrats left and right to gain their help on North Korea. Trump even showered praise on Vladimir Putin, saying he really believed the Russian autocrats' claim that he didn't meddle in the 2016 election, contradicting U.S. intelligence. The low point, said Jay Nordlinger in NationalReview.com, was Trump's meeting with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. When Duterte, who has defended the killing of journalists, called the assembled U.S. press spies, Trump chuckled along. If the supposed leader of the free world won't challenge Duterte's abysmal human rights record, he could at least refrain from laughing. Trump may aspire to be a strong man like Duterte or Putin, said Darlene Glanton in the Chicago Tribune, but they're better at it than he is. China's Xi, in particular, played him like a fool, wooing Trump with flattery and banquets until he shelved any notion of actually standing up to the Chinese on trade. Trump's most substantive statement of the trip, said Sohrab Ammari in CommentaryMagazine.com, was probably the childish tweet he sent from Vietnam mocking North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as short and fat. In the end, the search for a coherent Trump doctrine on foreign policy may find nothing but the signature mixture of childish insult and narcissistic grievance that drives much of his domestic agenda. With North Korean ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons now in the picture, that is no laughing matter. And we're into our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for German bureaucrats who welcomed the recent doubling of Twitter's character limit to 280 as a chance to tweet about a beef labeling law known as, I'm going to give this a try, Rindfleisch kalt ungeschwerberwack und saufgabonerber. I'm sure I didn't get that right, but it's one of the hardest looking words I've ever tried to pronounce. It was a good week for e-learning after a surfer in Australia escaped from the jaws of a shark by punching it on the nose. Charlie Fry, age 25, says he recently watched a YouTube clip of a pro surfer, Mick Fanning, doing the same in 2015. When it happened, I was like, just do what Mick did. And it was a good week for Barack Obama after British neuroscientists trained sheep to recognize the faces of famous people, including that of the 44th president. Scientist Jenny Morton says she picked Obama and other celebrities because I wanted people that the sheep had not met. But it was a bad week for hiding behind anti-Semitism after Alabama residents reported receiving robocalls from a Bernie Bernstein, supposedly a reporter at the Washington Post, offering money to women willing to make damaging remarks about candidate Roy Moore. Bernstein does not exist, and his methods, said Post Executive Director Marty Baron, bear no relationship to reality. It was a bad week for Holy Smokes after Pope Francis banned the sale of cigarettes at all shops in the Vatican. The stores can still sell cigars, said spokesman Greg Burke, because the smoke is not inhaled. It was a bad week for doffing after a Colorado man in court on drug charges removed his cowboy hat out of respect for the judge, causing a small package of alleged cocaine to fall from his hat band. And before we move on, a boring but important item here. State Department to offer buyouts. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson moved ahead this week with an effort to dramatically shrink the size of the State Department, with plans to offer $25,000 buyouts to hundreds of diplomats and employees if they retire by April. Tillerson's goal is to reduce the ranks of the State Department's 25,000 full-time employees by 8%, which amounts to 1,982 people, by September of 2018. Only 1,341 are expected to resign or retire by then, so the department will soon extend buyouts to the next 641 employees who agree to quit. Although Congress maintained the department's funding levels this year, Tillerson has persisted in his efforts to cut the payroll, implementing a hiring freeze and refusing to fill many ambassadorships and other senior positions. On the briefing page, when your face reveals everything, facial recognition technology could revolutionize everyday life, but at what cost? How does the technology work? It scans faces either in person or on a photograph and measures distinguishing facial features such as eye position, eyebrow shape, and nostril angle. This creates a distinctive digital face print, much like a fingerprint, which the system then runs through a database to check for a match. Law enforcement agencies have had faces on file for decades. Their databases provide them with the identified person's name, age, address, and any criminal history. But facial recognition is increasingly being used by commercial firms, too. Facebook's systems for tagging a photo, identifying who is in the picture, is now as accurate as users doing it themselves. Apple's new iPhone X or iPhone 10 can be unlocked when its owner simply looks at it. As the technology becomes more widespread, there are growing fears that it will erode privacy and be misused by bad actors. We need to ask ourselves, said Kelly Gates, author of Our Biometric Future, whether a world of ubiquitous automated identification is really one we want to build. Who uses this technology? Facial recognition is most common in China, where people can use it to pay for a coffee, visit tourist attractions, and even withdraw cash from ATMs. Several Chinese cities use face scanning cameras to shame jaywalkers by flashing their names and photographs on public display boards. But the West isn't lagging too far behind. In Europe, high-end hotels and retailers use facial recognition cameras to identify VIPs and celebrities as they enter in order to give them preferential treatment. Several U.S. airlines are looking to replace boarding passes with face scanners. Department stores are using facial recognition to monitor how customers react to certain product displays. And these developments are only the tip of the iceberg. What else is coming? Doctors have already started using facial recognition to help them diagnose rare genetic diseases that produce distinctive facial characteristics. As the technology improves, they should be able to do the same for more common conditions, such as autism. Shops will soon be able to identify individual customers as soon as they walk in the store and try to sell them specific items based on their interests and previous transactions. Dubai International Airport is scrapping one terminal's security clearance counter altogether and replacing it with a short tunnel fitted with 80 face-scanning cameras hidden behind video screens. Law enforcement agencies are also ramping up their facial recognition capacity. In what way? Through various state and federal databases, the FBI now has access to photographs of half the U.S. adult population, according to a major 2017 report by the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology. 80% of these people don't have a criminal record. Their faces are on file solely because they have some form of state ID, such as a residence card or driver's license. Several police departments, including Los Angeles, have even started using body cams for real-time facial recognition of people officers are talking to on the street or during traffic stops. But the system is far from flawless. 1 in 7 of the FBI's searches identifies an innocent party, even when the actual culprit is in the database. And facial recognition has always been less reliable for people with darker skin, because of the way light reflects off it, who are already arrested in disproportionately high numbers. If you're black, you're more likely to be affected by this technology, and that technology is more likely to be wrong, said Representative Elijah Cummings, a Democrat from Maryland. That's a hell of a combination. What are the other risks? The biggest danger is that authoritarian governments will use the technology to surveil and control their populations. Stanford University researchers made an algorithm that guessed someone's sexual orientation from a picture of their face with 81% accuracy. Humans managed only 61%. In countries where homosexuality is illegal, that could be a dangerous weapon. Find Face, a Russian app, can identify strangers by comparing their photo to more than 200 million social media profile pictures, and it's been used to harass people. Like any new tool, says Nicholas Rule, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, if it gets into the wrong hands, it can be used for ill purposes. Is there any regulation? European regulators have proposed that all biometric data, including face prints, belong to their owner and thus require consent to use. But U.S. lawmakers appear relatively unconcerned. Only Illinois and Texas have laws regulating facial recognition. Of 52 police agencies that have acknowledged using the technology, only one obtained legislative approval. Facial recognition still isn't as good as it is in the movies, with computers instantaneously identifying every individual in a huge crowd, but it's not that far off. From a technological perspective, the ability to successfully conduct mass-scale facial recognition in the wild seems inevitable, says Carnegie Mellon professor Alessandro Acquisti. Whether as a society we will accept that technology, however, is another story. Beating the algorithm. Tricking high-end facial recognition systems isn't easy. Wired magazine hired top Hollywood artists to create silicone face masks that would trick an iPhone 10 into believing it was seeing its owner. They failed. But there are ways to get the better of less advanced facial recognition systems. While wearing a regular hat, scarf, or pair of glasses makes little difference, particular patterns can confuse the software. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon created oversized colored glasses that not only masked the wearer's identity, but also made the software think the person was a celebrity. Others have created patterned scarves that look to machines like human faces. Some have even dabbled with face paint, covering up parts of their cheeks with specific blocks of colors to dazzle the scanner. But there's one major flaw in all these anti-surveillance techniques. They make you stick out like a sore thumb. The very thing that makes you invisible to computers, says tech writer Robinson Meyer in The Atlantic, makes you glaringly obvious to other humans. And we'll read a few of the best columns now, two from the U.S. Robert Samuelson from the Washington Post has one that says, Americans don't pay enough taxes. We're having the wrong debate about taxes, said Robert Samuelson. The argument over the GOP's proposed tax bill has focused on two issues. Will lower taxes stimulate economic growth? And does the plan unfairly favor the wealthy over the middle class? Interesting questions, to be sure, but mostly irrelevant to the nation's long-term well-being. The fact is, we simply cannot afford to reduce taxes. Or to put it another way, Americans are undertaxed. In only five of the past 50 years have tax revenues covered federal spending. The rest of the time, we've run deficits, during peace and war, with strong economies and weak, with low inflation and high. From 1990 to 2016, borrowing represented nearly 14% of the annual federal spending. That's $1 out of every seven. And the budget deficit, already $666 billion, will only grow as more baby boomers retire and claim Social Security and Medicare, putting us at true risk of a financial calamity. To rebalance the budget, painful steps would have to be taken. Some programs cut, some taxes hiked, but that's not a vote-winning message. Americans like big government. They just don't like paying for it. David French from NationalReview.com writes, blinded by our love for the troops. I'm a proud Army veteran, but I'm getting very worried about our nation's military worship, said David French. As anyone who's served knows, our armed forces are as prone to incompetence and corruption as any other institution. Last week, we discovered that the Texas church shooter was able to buy the guns he used to kill 26 innocents because the Air Force failed to alert law enforcement about his violent past. A few days later, it was revealed that 440 active duty and retired personnel, including 60 admirals, had been implicated in the Navy's so-called Fat Leonard corruption scandal. In any other government agency, such scandals would have triggered a public crisis of confidence. Yet the public's faith in the Department of Defense remains resolute, a product of our growing civil-military divide. Too many civilians, politicians, and pundits who haven't served view members of the military with a degree of deference, sometimes even awe, they haven't always earned. Combine this all with ignorance, and it's easy to see how military scandals can fester and grow into something terrible, like mass murder in Texas. Loving the troops and supporting the military should mean we hold both accountable. Honorable soldiers don't fear scrutiny, but when you worship the military, you hurt the military. And Giles William Goldnandel, this is from France, and La Figaro writes, why must we erase our Christian past? The secularist drive to rid France of any hint of its Christian past is becoming insane, says Giles William Goldnadel. A court has just ruled that a cross atop a statue of Pope John Paul II in the town of Ploermel in Brittany, sculpted by a Russian artist Zurab Tsereteli, must be removed. Apparently, it contravenes the 2004 ban on religious symbols in public, even though it is plainly just a symbolic ornament on a work of art. Or consider the case of the pots of Greek yogurt that the Lidl supermarket chain recently put on sale. They were decorated with pictures of Greek villages, but the Orthodox cross on the churches had been photoshopped out by the retailer to avoid offending anyone. For the same reason, the Paris transport system refused to let a charity display posters inviting donations for Christians suffering persecution in the Middle East. What's especially irritating is that the authorities are so strict about Christianity, our native religion, yet they positively encourage public religious activity by foreigners. It's considered fine, for example, for Paris mayor to stage an event at taxpayer expense to mark the end of Ramadan. The ban on religious symbols should mean more than giving offense to Christians. And we go to the last word, our in-depth article this week. Interestingly titled, How Silicon Valley Hooks Us. Tech engineers who helped make Facebook and Twitter so addictive are unplugging from the internet, said journalist Paul Lewis, concerned that their creations are hijacking users' minds. Justin Rosenstein had tweaked his laptop's operating system to block Reddit, banned himself from Snapchat, which he compares to heroin, and imposed limits on his use of Facebook. But even that wasn't enough. In August, the 34-year-old tech executive took a more radical step to restrict his use of social media and other addictive technologies. Rosenstein purchased a new iPhone and instructed his assistant to set up a parental control feature to prevent him from downloading apps. He was particularly aware of the allure of Facebook likes, which he describes as bright dings of pseudo-pleasure that can be as hollow as they are seductive. As Rosenstein should know, he was the Facebook engineer who created the like button in the first place. A decade after he stayed up all night coding a prototype of what was then called an awesome button, Rosenstein belongs to a small but growing band of Silicon Valley heretics who complain about the rise of so-called attention economy, an internet shaped around the demands of advertising. These refuseniks are rarely founders or chief executives who have little incentive to deviate from the mantra that their companies are making the world a better place. Instead, they tend to have worked a rung or two down the corporate ladder. Designers, engineers, and product managers who, like Rosenstein, several years ago put in place the building blocks of a digital world from which they are now trying to disentangle themselves. Rosenstein, who also helped create GChat during a stint at Google and now leads a San Francisco-based company that improves office productivity, appears most concerned about the psychological effects on people who, research shows, touch, swipe, or tap their phones 2,617 times a day. There is growing concern that, as well as addicting users, technology is contributing to so-called continuous partial attention, severely limiting people's ability to focus and possibly lowering IQ. One recent study showed that mere presence of smartphones damages cognitive capacity, even when the device is turned off. Everyone is distracted, Rosenstein says, all of the time. But these concerns are trivial compared with the devastating impact upon the political system that some of Rosenstein's peers believe can be attributed to the rise of social media and the attention-based market that drives it. Drawing a straight line between addiction to social media and political earthquakes like Brexit and the rise of Donald Trump, they contend that digital forces have upended the political system and left unchecked, could even render democracy as we know it obsolete. Rosenstein's colleague, Leah Perlman, then a product manager at Facebook, announced that Facebook like in a 2009 blog post. Now 35 and an illustrator, Perlman, too, has grown disaffected with likes and other addictive feedback loops. One reason I think it is particularly important for us to talk about this now is that we may be the last generation that can remember life before. One morning in April this year, designers, programmers, and tech entrepreneurs gathered at a conference center on the shore of San Francisco Bay. They had each paid up to $1,700 to learn how to manipulate people into habitual use of their products on a course by Nir Eyal. Eyal, 39, the author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, has spent several years consulting for the tech industry, teaching techniques he developed by closely studying how the Silicon Valley giants operate. The technologies we use have turned into compulsions, if not full-fledged addictions, Eyal writes. It's the impulse to check a message notification. It's the pull to visit YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter for just a few minutes, only to find yourself still tapping and scrolling an hour later. None of this is an accident, he writes. It is all just as their designers intended. Eyal wanted to address the concern that technological manipulation was somehow harmful or immoral. He was dismissive of those who compare tech addiction to drugs. We're not freebasing Facebook and injecting Instagram here, he said. He flashed up a slide of the shelf filled with sugary baked goods. Just as we shouldn't blame the baker for making such delicious treats, we can't blame tech makers for making their products so good we want to use them. Without irony, Eyal finished his talk with some personal tips for resisting the lure of technology. He told his audience he uses a Chrome extension called DF YouTube, which scrubs out a lot of those external triggers, he writes about it in his book. And he recommended an app called Pocket Points that rewards you for staying off your phone when you need to focus. Finally, Eyal confided the lengths he goes to protect his own family. He has installed in his house an outlet timer that cuts off access to the internet at a set time every day. The idea is to remember that we are not powerless, he said. We are in control. But are we? If the people who built these technologies are taking such radical steps to wean themselves free, can the rest of us be expected to exercise our free will? Not according to Tristan Harris, a 33-year-old former Google employee turned vocal critic of the tech industry. All of us are jacked into the system, he says. All of our minds can be hijacked. Our choices are not as free as we think they are. Harris, who has been branded the closest thing Silicon Valley has to a conscience, insists that billions of people have little choice over whether they use these now ubiquitous technologies and are largely unaware of the invisible ways in which a small number of people in Silicon Valley are shaping their lives. A graduate of Stanford University, Harris studied under B.J. Fogg, a behavioral psychologist revered in tech circles for mastering the ways technological design can be used to persuade people. Harris is the student who went rogue, lifting the curtain on the vast powers accumulated by tech companies and the ways they are using influence. I don't know a more urgent problem than this, Harris says. It's changing our democracy. It's changing our ability to have the conversations and relationships that we want with each other. It all began in 2013 when he was working as a product manager at Google and circulated a thought-provoking memo, a call to minimize distraction and respect users' attention to 10 close colleagues. It struck a chord, spreading to some 5,000 Google employees, including senior executives who rewarded Harris with an impressive-sounding new job. He was to be Google's in-house design ethicist and product philosopher. Looking back, Harris sees that he was promoted into a marginal role. Still, he adds, I got to sit in a corner and think and read and understand. He explored how LinkedIn exploits a need for social reciprocity to widen its network, how YouTube and Netflix autoplay videos and next episodes, depriving users of a choice about whether or not they want to keep watching, how Snapchat created its addictive Snapstreaks feature, encouraging near-constant communication between its mostly teenage users. The techniques these companies use are not always generic. They can be algorithmically tailored to each person. An internal Facebook report leaked this year revealed that the company can identify when teens feel insecure and worthless. Such granular information, Harris adds, is a perfect model of what buttons you can push. Tech companies can exploit such vulnerabilities to keep people hooked, manipulating, for example, when people receive likes for their posts, ensuring they arrive when an individual is likely to feel vulnerable or in need of approval, or maybe just bored. And the very same techniques can be sold to the highest bidder. There's no ethics, he says. Harris believes that tech companies never deliberately set out to make their products addictive. They were responding to the incentives of an advertising economy, experimenting with techniques that might capture people's attention, even stumbling across highly effective design by accident. A friend at Facebook told Harris that designers initially decided the notification icon, which alerts people to new activity such as friend requests, should be blue. But no one used it, Harris said. Then they switched it to red. And of course, everyone used it. That red icon is now everywhere. When smartphone users glance at their phones dozens or hundreds of times a day, they are confronted with small red dots beside their apps, pleading to be tapped. Red is a trigger color, Harris says. That's why it's used as an alarm signal. The most seductive design, Harris explains, exploits the same psychological susceptibility that makes gambling so compulsive. Variable rewards. When we tap those apps with red icons, we don't know whether we'll discover an interesting email, an avalanche of likes, or nothing at all. It's this that explains how the pull-to-refresh mechanism, whereby users swipe down, pause, and wait to see what content appears, rapidly became one of the most addictive and ubiquitous design features in modern technology. Each time you're swiping down, it's like a slot machine, Harris says. You don't know what's coming next. The designer who created the pull-to-refresh mechanism is Lauren Brichter, 32, who says he never intended to design the design to be addictive, but he did not dispute the slot machine comparison. I agree 100%, he says. I have two kids now, and I regret every minute that I'm not paying attention to them because my phone has sucked me in. In the wake of Donald Trump's stunning electoral victory, many were quick to question the role of so-called fake news on Facebook, Russian-created Twitter bots, or the data-centric targeting efforts that companies such as Cambridge Analytica used to sway voters. But James Williams, who built the metrics for Google's global search advertising business and is now doing a PhD at Oxford in persuasive design, sees those factors as symptoms of a deeper problem. It was not just shady or bad actors who were exploiting the internet to change public opinion. The attention economy itself is set up to promote a phenomenon like Trump, who is masterful at grabbing and retaining the attentions of supporters and critics alike, often by exploiting or creating outrage. In a blog published a month before the U.S. election, Williams sounded the alarm on an issue he argued was far more consequential question than whether Trump reached the White House. The reality TV star's campaign, he said, had heralded a watershed in which the news, digitally supercharged dynamics of the attention economy have finally crossed a threshold and become manifest in the political realm. Williams saw a similar dynamic unfold months earlier during the Brexit campaign, when the attention economy appeared to him biased in favor of the emotional, identity-based case for the UK leaving the European Union. He stresses these dynamics are not unique to the political right. They also play a role in the popularity of left-wing politicians, such as Bernie Sanders, and the frequent internet outrage over issues that ignite fury among progressives. All of which, Williams says, is not only distorting the way we view politics, but over time may be changing the way we think, making us less rational and more impulsive. We've habituated ourselves to a perpetual cognitive style of outrage, he says. Williams argues the recent fixation on the surveillance state fictionalized by George Orwell is likely misplaced. It was another English science fiction writer, Aldous Huxley, who provided the more prescient observation when he warned that Orwellian-style coercion was less of a threat to democracy than the subtle power of man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. The dynamics of the attention economy are structurally set up to undermine the human will. Williams says, if politics is an expression of our human will, then the attention economy is undermining the assumptions that democracy rests on. If Facebook, Google, and Twitter are chipping away at our ability to control our own minds, could there come a point, I ask, at which democracy no longer functions? Will we be able to recognize it if and when it happens, Williams replies. And if we can't, then how do we know it isn't happening already? This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. We will read a couple of the short pieces from the Health and Science page this week. The first one probably comes as no surprise. Americans stressed out over politics. Americans are having a collective freakout. Fear and anxiety about politics and the future of the country are a significant source of stress for nearly two-thirds of adults in the U.S., new research has found. The American Psychological Association's Stress in America survey paints a grim picture of the nation's collective mental health. Nearly 60% of the 3,440 people polled say they consider the present day to be the lowest point in our nation's history that they can remember, reports Fortune.com. Pessimism is highest among Democrats and millennials, but also affects most Republicans and older adults who lived through World War II and Vietnam. We're seeing significant stress transcending party lines, said Arthur Evans, CEO of the American Psychological Association. The uncertainty and generalized anxiety people have about the country, he said, feels unique to this point in recent history. Social divisiveness worries 59% of Americans. 43% are stressed about health care, and 35% are fearful about the economy. Other causes of anxiety are distrust of the government, media negativity, crime, terrorism, and international conflicts. Many of those surveyed admit they are losing sleep and experiencing headaches or other physical signs of stress. When the stress becomes chronic, Evan says, it can have real health consequences. Giza's hidden chamber. The Great Pyramid of Giza was built some 4,500 years ago, but scientists are still uncovering secrets hidden within its towering limestone walls. Using a sophisticated imaging technique called muon radiography, researchers were able to peer inside the massive structure and discover a previously undetected and inaccessible empty space measuring at least 98 feet long and 26 feet high, reports NationalGeographic.com. The newly found chamber is situated above the Grand Gallery, the sloping corridor at the heart of the pyramid that links the burial chambers of the king and queen. Experts speculate that the space served an architectural purpose during the pyramid's construction, or could have been a secret room with unknown contents. But study author co-author Mehdi Tayubi says the role of the void is a mystery. What we do know, he says, is that this void is there, that it is impressive, and that it was not expected by any kind of theory. It's not possible to reach the space without damaging the historical structure, so Egyptologists may have to settle for guesswork. And we'll finish out the hour on the Talking Points page. Here we have an article titled, Middle East, Saudi Arabia's Reckless Prince. We're entering a new phase in the Middle East's crisis-ridden history, says Tamara Kiblawi in CNN.com. And it could be the bloodiest yet. Last weekend, on the same day Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had dozens of princes and top officials detained for corruption, Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri unexpectedly traveled to Riyadh and announced his resignation. Presumably acting on the orders of his Saudi political patrons, Hariri accused the Iranian-backed militant and political group Hezbollah of taking over his country. Saudi officials then further ramped up pressure on Iran, saying a missile fired at Riyadh by a Tehran-backed militia in Yemen amounted to an act of war. These developments represent a sharp escalation in the decades-long standoff between Shiite Iran and Sunni-majority Saudi Arabia. The two regional powers are already fighting bitter proxy wars in Yemen and Syria. Is Riyadh preparing to take things a step further? Whatever the Saudis are up to, they're dragging Washington with them, said Aaron David Miller and Richard Sikorsky in foreignpolicy.com. Riyadh went to great lengths to woo President Trump during his state visit in May, and the charm offensive worked. Last week, Trump tweeted praise for the Crown Prince's domestic purge. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and advisor, spent several days in Riyadh with Mohammed last month, suggesting the administration may even have been forewarned. But Trump is playing a risky game. The Saudis cannot take on Iran alone, and they'll need us to bail them out when they get in over their heads. Mohammed's goal isn't to fight Iran or even Hezbollah, said Jane Ferguson in PBS.org. It's to push Israel into doing it for him. Jerusalem views Tehran's growing regional dominance as an existential threat. And if the Israelis believe Hezbollah has grown too strong, they may feel compelled to act. To do that, though, they'll want U.S. military aid and assistance. Mohammed is clearly ambitious, said Mark Lynch in WashingtonPost.com. But the 32-year-old's foreign policy has proved disastrous. The war he championed against Tehran-backed rebels in Yemen is a humanitarian catastrophe with no foreseeable path to victory. His blockade of Qatar, a chaotic effort to impose Saudi-UAE leadership on the region, has led to an entrenched stalemate. This latest bid for a rapid, politically popular victory abroad will follow the same pattern, yielding a bloody, destabilizing quagmire. And a few shorter notes. First, deceased New England Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez suffered the most severe case of chronic traumatic encephalopathy ever discovered in a person his age, researchers at Boston University have revealed. The football player who hanged himself in his prison cell in April at age 27 while serving a life sentence for murder would have experienced significant damage to his decision-making, judgment, and cognition as a result of his brain injuries, said doctors. A self-driving shuttle bus got into an accident on its first day in Las Vegas as it cruised one block east of the Vegas Strip. Police said another vehicle with a human driver was to blame for backing up into the bus, which couldn't go into reverse. At least 14 House Republicans have announced that they won't seek re-election in 2018, compared with just two Democrats. After the church massacre in Sutherland Springs, Texas last week, the 1999 Columbine school shooting is no longer among the 10 deadliest mass shootings in post-war America. When it occurred, Columbine was the first mass shooting in nearly 8 years that killed 10 or more people, and after 1999, 7 years would pass without one. By comparison, five of the past 6 years have included at least one shooting with 10 or more deaths. On the poll watch, 54% of Americans say they trust the media more than President Trump to tell the truth about important issues. 34% trust the president more. And we've got time for two quotes today. The first comes from novelist Colm McCann, quoted in the Boston Globe. He says, "In the end, the only things worth doing are the things that might possibly break your heart. Rage on." And this from sports legend Babe Didrikson, quoted in GolfChannel.com. She says, "The babe is here. Who's coming in second?" And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.